That's right. We're going old school tonight. It's all UFOs all the time. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. Listen to that bumper music. It's time to disconnect. We're going to take phone calls all night, and it's Clifford Stone. George Norrie and Friends is coming up August 27th in Asheville, living it up in Asheville. George Norrie is going to welcome William Forstian, a ufologist and good friend, Micah Hanks, and paranormal investigator extraordinaire, the one and only Joshua P. Warren. And a meet and greet is going to follow the show. It's all happening at the Diana Wortham Theater in Asheville, North Carolina, August 27th. Tickets and info are over at coasttocoastam.com. And I am going to be at the Awareness Life Expo, August 13th and 14th, up at the Crown Plaza Hotel in Sacramento, California. I'm going to be broadcasting live that Friday, August 12th, at a special VIP party at the hotel. And tickets and info are over at jimmychurchradio.com. And there you go. In the world of UFO research, the name of retired Army Sergeant Clifford Stone is legend. And he is our guest up next. This is Coast to Coast AM. Decorated Vietnam combat veteran Sergeant Clifford Stone served 22 years. He led a double life from the late 60s through his retirement in 1990. While officially assigned to an NBC team, that's Nuclear Biological and Chemical Hazard Retrieval and Abatement Detail, he also served on top-secret UFO crash retrieval missions, where he had physical contact with not only downed ET craft, and where he interacted directly with captured non-human life forms. The official NBC team assignment allegedly served as a cover for those highly secretive and compartmented operations. Over a period of nearly 40 years, he has amassed one of the largest private collections of authentic documents that clearly establish the hard reality of the UFO phenomenon. I would like to welcome back to Coast AM our good friend, Clifford Stone. Clifford, good evening.
Good evening, sir.
How are you?
Doing okay.
You just did 4 days out at the Roswell Festival, just like we did. Have you recovered? Has the city recovered?
Oh, yes, sir. But everything's back to normal right now.
And the city, it was my first trip out there with my wife, Rita, to the UFO Festival. But the one thing that I can say, you live in Roswell, and I have to clearly admit here, the city embraces that not only the UFO phenomenon, but what happened in Roswell in 1947, and they get it there, don't they?
Yeah, there's a whole lot of people who know what happened. You still have a whole lot of people that don't want to talk.
Right.
And a lot of people don't understand that. They think that it's very open and everyone's talking about what really did happen here in 47. But there are still those people who don't want to talk. And I don't understand that. As you know, I had an incident here the first part of June. And I went all the way from here all the way to Alamogordo, trying to find witnesses to what I had seen. I found people who observed what I saw. Some even took video, but they were scared to death to talk. And I don't understand that. But I guess, you know, we live in a strange world today, and when it comes to the U.S., it's even stranger because it's just ironic how many people fear the government. And that should never be the case.
And when I got to see you speak briefly there in Roswell, and one of the things that you, I want to say this correctly, referred to, and I was just amazed, was the technology that ET would be using theoretically to get here and where our technology rests today. And how we shouldn't be shocked or astonished about how they were getting here because of our own knowledge of what we have here.
Oh, absolutely. The whole situation is that we today have a greater understanding of that technology than we did, say, in the 1940s or the early 1950s. You know, the situation is their mode of travel is not as we travel. The aerodynamics that are involved aren't aerodynamics per se as we understand aerodynamics. We have to have airfoils that are aerodynamically sound so they can fly. But good example, the flying wing. A lot of people aren't even aware of the fact that the Germans developed the flying wing during the Second World War. Fortunately for us, it wasn't aerodynamically sound. It wasn't good at maneuvering. And when we started to make our flying wing early on, once again in the late 40s, early 50s, it wasn't very maneuverable. But when we started to make the B-2 bomber, and the reason we could do that was because of the introduction of computers that can make second-by-second corrections in flight. But when we started to do that, we went back to look at the Germans' flying wing. Now, none survived, but we have wreckage of one in the Smithsonian. So we went back and looked at that. And the interesting thing was the Germans knew, even while the war was going on, that the shape of the flying wing caused it to be almost invisible to radar. And of course, today we have composites that we put on our aircraft that make them more stealthy. But back in the day, that flying wing was being made. Also, they were working on the atomic bomb because in April of 46, had the war not come to an end, they planned on dropping a bomb using their flying wing on New York City. But that's just an example of our technology. You go into their technology, when they first started to come here, we were saying it was impossible because, you know, we would see them going at 7,000, 9,000 miles an hour, and there's no sonic boom. And based on what we understood then, that was impossible. You could not do that. But they're displacing time space. When they come here, they use a means of what we call traversable wormholes. They get from point A to point B, and the one that I always like to try to point out is you take a star system that's 100 light years from planet Earth. That means it takes light 100 years to get from that star system to planet Earth. By using a traversable wormhole and using antimatter drives, an antimatter propulsion system to traverse that wormhole, in real time it takes them an hour and 40 minutes to get from that star system to here at on planet Earth.
Clifford, are we tracking them? Are we tracking them the same as we track objects, not only satellites, but stuff that is inside of our atmosphere? Are we tracking these objects as they approach us?
Oh, absolutely. On any given day, we pick up many what we call UCTs, that uncorrelated targets. Up on final review, many of those uncorrelated targets remain unknowns. And we pick them up both in near-Earth orbit and we pick them up in deep space, which is something that a lot of people aren't aware of. And just trying to go and verify or to try to get answers on, say, just one UCT, it requires 2,000 to 3,000 man hours. When you take into consideration that in a year's time, we can pick up as many as a couple hundred to a couple thousand. We catalog these. We give them numbers. So we can keep track of them. Sometimes they have what's called fading, where they're there for a little while, then they simply just disappear. But no, we keep track of them. NORAD has what they call a catalog, in which they list all the space objects that are out there, all the satellites. Now, it's key that this is everyone understands satellites, not just debris, but satellites. It consists of 101 pages. If you go ahead and you do an extraction just on the unknowns, you come up with three and a half pages of unknowns, and we're talking about 30 to 40 on each page. So, yes, we are, in fact, tracking these. And what a lot of people don't know, the NORAD and the Air Force, back when it was the Continental Air Defense Command, they are known back then and they are known today, what we call tracks of interest when they're picked up on radar. And sometimes, true, these turn out to just be aircraft that aren't using transponders, or did not file a flight plan, or they are off their flight plan, or enter an ADIZ, air restricted corridor. But approximately 20% of those remain unknown even after we make attempts at identifying them. And back in 1951, based on a secret document, the Air Defense Controller Room, they would go ahead and filter out what they called TOIs, targets of interest, tracks of interest. They had another room set up about the same size as the control room, in which all filtered TOIs would be sent to, and that room is dedicated solely to try to explain the TOIs.
Right.
And the purpose of coming up with different names is that they did not like the term UFO, because if you talk UFOs, one, everybody immediately jumps to the conclusion you're referring to interplanetary spacecraft. Two, it makes it more difficult for them to conceal it. So right now when people come up with things like unidentified aerial phenomena, UAPs, are UTCs, uncorrelated targets, or TOIs, people really don't know what you're referring to, but at the same time, I'll tell you right now, some of those are in fact craft that did not originate on this planet. They come from somewhere else, and not necessarily interplanetary, but they can be multidimensional. When you're traversing through traversable wormholes, you're actually traversing that time by utilizing, I'm not a physicist, so I can't really explain this real good, but you are bending space-time.
Right, and what I want to understand here is when they do exit the wormhole, is that happening inside of our solar system? Are the TOIs suddenly showing up in our solar system and we start tracking them from there?
Well, actually, when they exit the mouth of the wormhole, it's got to be out outside of the atmosphere. Then they enter the Earth's atmosphere, normally over the polar region, which is why a couple of times we almost went to war by accident, because we would pick up these UFOs coming in, and immediately we would go ahead and put our forces on alert And back during the Cold War, when you put them on alert, the bombers started to take off to areas where they were going to be heading to bomb in the former Soviet states. And, of course, we'd send up a message and state, you know, this was a test, or this is a no-go. We finally figured out, like in 1950, they had a situation where we got very close to going to war because of that scenario. What I like is some of the ways they try to explain these objects coming in over polar regions. I have yet to figure out the flock of birds that was picked up over the northern polar region, which was picked up as being enemy bombers traveling at several thousand miles an hour, but yet it took them 20 minutes to determine that, oh, these were nothing but a flock of birds. So if anybody knows about a flock of birds that flies over the polar caps, I'd like to know about that.
The wormhole itself, are you saying that it is close enough? It is close to Earth? Is that what you're saying? And they literally exit out and go straight into our atmosphere?
Oh, absolutely. But they don't necessarily have to go straight into our atmosphere. I would even suggest that many times they're close to the Interplanetary Space Station.
Right.
They will exit very close to the Interplanetary Space Station because they're interested in our activities there. And I would further suggest that they probably have, for whatever reason they may need bases, they have bases on both the Moon and Mars.
Right. See, I was imagining or picturing the wormhole out, say, beyond Jupiter or Saturn or Uranus. But if it's closer to Earth or our Moon or Mars, then we wouldn't have to track them or try to pick them up all the way across the solar system. They would simply appear very close to us.
Oh, absolutely. But you got to keep in mind also that many times there are objects that are in what we call deep space that we track and pick up.
Right.
You know, it's up to them where they decide to come into. But they, fortunately, a few times they have entered the Earth's atmosphere, where they exited the wormhole, and this has created a lot of damage on the ground. There was one instance back in the late 60s, up in a region in Canada, where they actually came through the wormhole and they were in the atmosphere. And it created damage on the ground in an area of a radius of about 600 miles. The cover story for that was that there was a power station that had several transformers that blew up.
Well, let me jump in right there. We're going to take a break. We're going to pick all of this up on the backside. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. Our guest tonight, Clifford Stone. We'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. Our guest tonight, Clifford Stone. We are going old school UFO all night. And we're going to be taking your calls, too, as well, for the rest of the evening. Now, Clifford, one of the things that, and when you go back to the old UFO hypothesis, which was the nuts and bolts craft and how would they get here from, you know, another universe, another solar system, and get here on a small craft, it when we look back at that now, it doesn't make any sense. But it does make sense to me if they are arriving here through a wormhole and possibly to a base on the Moon. And then they could just cruise here from the Moon to here, and then a small craft makes sense.
Yeah, but let me talk a little about the small craft. The situation is that in one instance, and this actually happened not too far from Augusta, Georgia in 1973.
Okay.
We went inside of a small craft. It was about 30, 35 foot in diameter. The problem is when we went on the inside of the craft, you know, either we got smaller or it was very huge on the inside.
Right.
We went to the center where it had, you know, and I hate using the term doors because I can't explain it. I'm going to say doors, but they wasn't doors as we understand doors. That led to other compartments for around this center of the craft on the inside. We had a measuring tape that was 100 foot long. I had one of my soldiers hold it at one side. I started to walk across. Then I thought he was holding it up. And I said, let go of it. Let me try to get, you know, what the actual size is here. And he says, Sarge, you're at the end of the tape. And I still had a long way to go. What's going on, the best way I can explain it, and remember I'm not a scientist, is that even with inside the craft, you're dealing with multi-dimensional realities.
Right.
And we believe there is at least 11 dimensional realities that you're working with there. And I'm not really supposed to know that, but that old adage, I get by with a little help from my friends,
right,
that comes into play. But trying to understand it, it's about like, you know, you being a first grader and you're having a premier professor from a university trying to explain to you how all this works. And it's very hard to take in, and it boggles the imagination totally. I mean, you know, you look on the inside, you see it's much bigger, and you're wondering, how can this be?
Right, right, right.
And, you know, it really is. I mean, I remember thinking, okay, we're either getting smaller or something's going on here.
So you were outside of the craft, it looked, you know, whatever size, but it's small. And you walk in, and the inside is big. You walk back outside and turn around and look at it, and it doesn't fit on the outside what you were just witnessing on the inside. Am I understanding you correctly?
Oh, correct. There's no ways to put it in words.
Now, what about, okay, so let's take this a step further. Were there multiple floors on the inside, on the outside of the craft? It looks
actually,
like it's
only
one.
That's why it's hard to explain about
right. Doors
not being our idea of doors.
I have heard from witnesses before when they talk about, you know, seeing the craft on the outside, then they're on the inside and they're walking down hallways, they're going through doors, and they're into this room and into this room. And when the description of the craft, it's not that big. There are no hallways. There can only be one room on the inside. And so I guess I'm understanding now why there could be hallways and multiple floors.
Well, I mean, you know, when we had this going on and they were trying to ask us, okay, just, and this is the hardest part for people. Like, you may have people that in the military that's only involved in one instance with a UFO, but you may have some people who are involved a couple times over. And I know it has an impact on people. I mean, I know we have pilots who won't talk about it. They don't even tell their families. And it has an impact on their lives. I mean, I've known military people that literally, you know, they believe that God created planet Earth and that there was nothing else out there. God created this planet, put the stars and everything out there just for us.
Right.
Not thinking about even the possibility of having life out there. Then all of a sudden you're confronted with this. Sometimes they'll go ahead and try to sell you their demons and stuff of this sort. They're not demons. They're from advanced civilizations. And I know of cases where people have taken their own life because it literally destroyed everything they believed in their conception of what reality was crumbled. And that was something that was hard for me to take, because I felt, you know, if we worked with these people a little more, but we don't do that. What we do is that the people who are there, they are briefed in and briefed out. And that's where it's supposed to end. If they're brought back into another situation, once again, you're always briefed in.
Right.
And then you're briefed out.
Well, how did it change your reality? And, you know, I know you. You're grounded. Your head is there. But you could have obviously gone the other way with it once you were exposed to this. How did you your reality change for yourself?
Well, as a very young child, I had to make a decision. I had to decide whether I was going to go ahead. And I see an entity that follows me throughout my life, and as he puts it, will be around to mourn my death. When that happened to me, I had to make a decision. If I tried to fight it, it would destroy me. If I decided that this was something that I was going to have to accept and it would be part of my life for the rest of my life, but I could try to learn from it. And that's the course that I decided to take. I can remember when I first saw the entity that followed me, I always saw them as little children.
Right.
Then this little boy, I'm highly emotional. When I see other people hurting or hear about bad things happen, it really affects me. And when our visitors choose people that they're going to follow throughout life to learn more about our social structures, our societies, they actually get to the point where they feel your emotions. And the first time I saw him, as I saw him, as he really was, and not just the little boy, I found this little baby bird that fell out of a tree. And I took it home because its beak was broke and it was bleeding and it was yelping, and I want to try to save it. I want to try to help it. So if you have a cut, what do? As a kid, you go, you hold it underwater and wash the blood off, and that's supposed to also help stop it from bleeding, which it really doesn't. I know that now that I'm grown up, but as a kid, that's the way I saw you stop bleeding by holding it underwater. I held the little bird underwater, and I killed the little bird.
Okay.
And that broke my heart.
Of course.
And I committed murder. I mean, that bird would never see its mother and father again. The mother and father is going to grieve over the loss of that bird. And I was really stressing out over that. And, you know, I've always been pretty much a loner, so there's no one I could go and talk to. All of a sudden, this creature appears to me, and he wants to know what the water in my eyes was. Why was I having the feelings I was having? And I went ahead and tried to understand what I was seeing, but, you know, I panicked. I went and tried to hide. And the first place I went, the couch in the front room was catacorn, and there was an area in back of it. I hid behind there. And all of a sudden, over the couch, he's looking right at me and asking me, what are you trying to do? And I screamed out again. I ran, and the last place I wound up was a little area between the kitchen sink and the refrigerator. And I felt like these bony hands scratching my head. And it was like saying, you can run, but you can't hide. And it was at that time that my aunt, my mom was in the hospital at the time. She thought I was acting up, so she put me in a chair and tried to make me sit in that chair and said, you stay there till you calm down. And she literally had to hold me in that chair. And it was at that point I had to decide, you know, this is either going to destroy me, or I have to accept it. And, of course, then we had to go ahead and hit up on building our relationship back together, because I now knew that the children I was seeing that no one else could see were not children. I now knew that there was more to that. And I knew that this one was going to follow me throughout my life. And I wasn't real happy about that, but I had to decide, okay, fine. And now I understand there's a young lady that came out that was, I think, in Africa, where she's stating that essentially one of the entities she saw there that was at a school, and a whole lot of the school kids saw it, and I told a friend of mine by the name of Ed, when he and I were talking about it over the phone, I told him that I honestly believed that they were going to select some of the kids from there, and they were going to be following them, because this is something that's been going on long before it even happened to me. It happened to other people.
Right.
And, you know, I had to make a decision where I was going to start talking about it so I could help others understand what they were going through, help others who find themselves in a situation where they're in the military and come face-to-face with the unknown, that it's nothing to fear, it's something that will learn from it. You need to tell your families. If you don't want to tell no one else, that's fine, but you at least need to tell your families, because there's a price you have to pay by them not knowing.
Well, let me ask you this, because when you approach a crashed craft and you're on a retrieval mission, and one of the occupants is injured, now that you had the experience with the bird and also with your friend growing up, were you able to understand their pain or feel their pain, and was that communicated to you?
Oh, absolutely. The situation is that we also had a book, and we referred to our visitors as Heinz 57. And the reason we did that was at the time that I saw the book, there was 57 different species that had been identified. And, of course, first aid that we use on ourselves doesn't necessarily work for all of our visitors. So we had to go ahead and devise ways to try to take care of them using their own techniques. And actually, the organization that controls all this within the CIA, and it's almost like a rogue element within the CIA, it's the Office of Special Operations. They have a dedicated group within that office that deals solely with the UFO phenomenon. They are the ones also that go ahead and try to tell the military people, because they don't like the term UFOs, like in Vietnam. They were enemy helicopters.
Right.
And when we went ahead and called them UFOs, immediately we were corrected, these are enemy helicopters. Then we had one person that was Special Forces, a lieutenant, tell us about he had been to the site of where one of the helicopters was shot down. And I told him, make me a believer, take me to the enemy helicopter that was shot down. And he says, well, it's in hostile territory. And I says, I'll take my chances. Make me a believer, take me there. And, of course, he didn't. Later on, I was visited and told I need to watch my mouth, or I could find myself being court-martialed. And, you know, I had that thrown in my face a couple times over. It was actually right here while I was stationed at the Institute here at Roswell that they were thinking about court-martialing me. I tried to go ahead and have me, well, they sent me for psychoanalysis, and I passed that. And they wasn't real happy about that, but the psychologist went ahead, had other instances, I guess, where he had people had the same thing happen to them. And he told me, and I can't tell you how you're going to deal with this in your command, but if I was you, I would put in for reassignment. And I said, no. I'm not running away from this, period. And, of course, I started to talk openly about it, but I tried to go ahead and downplay it like it was a hobby. I wasn't officially involved. And I finally got to the point where I told the brass that be, look, if you want to go ahead and make this official. We'll make it official. I'll start talking about my involvement while I'm still in the military about things we have done.
Let me ask you this, Clifford. With all of your documents that you have, and as you read through, are the Russians tracking, and do they have the same abilities that we do to track? And are they coming back with the same information that you have compiled?
Oh, yes. They are very much involved with trying to find out what they can about UFOs. As a matter of fact, when the last time when I went to Germany and I decided to get out of the military, with what happened to me here, I decided, okay, I'm not going to be involved in UFOs anymore, no matter what they say. Well, when I got to Germany, I was told that I was going to be back involved with UFOs. Well, if I didn't like it, I could sue them. Well, knowing that the people who had control of this wasn't Army, per se, I put in my request for retirement and kept quiet about it, came home on leave.
Well, let's pick this up on the backside. We gotta hit a break right now, but the Russian connection to this is interesting for me. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. We'll be right back with Clifford Stone.